end, I would like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She is a storyteller. She speaks all over the world on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
So today we're talking about the opera Arabella by Richard Strauss. Excuse my German pronunciation.
Yeah, that's very good. You do it again.
Richard Strauss.
You see, great.
And Ugo von Hofmannsthal is the librettist, right?
Is that German mother that does it, right?
Every time.
Well, this is one of Strauss's great operas. He had an amazing career, and against a background of wartime Vienna. And this opera is focused on Vienna, actually. Vienna, the glorious city, which was at the height of its magnificence when they wrote the opera Der Rosenkavalier. They wrote about that particular time. Their operatic career for Strauss and von Hofmannsthal is sort of interesting. They started with Salome and Elektra, which are wildly expressionistic operas. They were very difficult operas. But then they sort of drew back with Der Rosenkavalier, which was the third opera. This was sort of in a neoclassical, almost Mozartian style, complete with the Knight of the Silver Rose, the Young Cavalier, sung by a mezzo-soprano, a panzero. So that was a great piece. And then he did a number of other operas, and then comes to Arabella. He had just finished composing the Egyptian Helena, and he wrote to von Hofmannsthal, his good friend. Hofmannsthal was a poet, first and foremost. He was an intellectual, whereas Strauss was much more a man of the theater. They came from different backgrounds and places, but their collaboration was very interesting. So at this point, Strauss writes to von Hofmannsthal saying, "I don't have anything to do right now. I'm bored. I want to keep my hand in. Can you throw something together?" Which sort of totally insulted von Hofmannsthal. He said, "I just can't throw something together for you. It doesn't work that way, and it would be a disaster." So that's where it started out, and Strauss is searching. Half of the lives of these composers seems to be searching for the right libretti.
It's interesting that they had such different styles of working, and they worked together for so long with such deep mutual respect.
Yeah,
and yet they had such different kind of styles and ways of thinking and ways of composing.
Yeah, they came from very different places, the two men. They didn't meet that often, so which is great for
which
us.
Which probably helped.
Maybe it did, but it also means that we have the letters, so we know what happened. I mean, today, trying to track the compositional process of a new opera is a nightmare because it's all done on email, which are probably discarded and nobody keeps. I mean, people used to keep letters so you could track this process. I think the creative process of how these operas come into being is really interesting. So anyway, von Hofmannsthal put his thinking cap on and he searched amongst his various sources and came up with a play that he had actually thought of doing some years earlier about a family in Vienna who was short of money. Their money had run out, and they have to marry one of their two daughters off to an eligible suitor.
It sounds like a Jane Austen novel.
It is a bit, I suppose, set in Vienna.
Set in Vienna, sort of fading aristocracy.
Yes, exactly.
Who lost their money.
Yes, they are. I mean, they've rented this apartment in a glamorous hotel on the Ringstrasse for the season, hoping that Arabella will land a good husband, but they're really out of money. In fact, when the Count Waldner requests a glass of brandy, the waiter comes to the door and says, "We've been told not to give you any more, no more service to this room because they're not paying their bills. It's that bad." Anyway, they start working on this, and it took Strauss a little while to get excited about the piece. He thought maybe Mandrika was going to be the central character, and then he wanted Arabella to be the center, but he wasn't getting very excited about Arabella's character. He felt she was a little thin. So they went through a lot of trial and error, I suppose, trying different ways of bringing Arabella to life. And then it all fell into place, as these things do. And von Hofmannsthal came up with the idea of writing a piece for her called Albe der Richtige, When I Find the Right Man. And that suddenly gave shape and form to her character, which Strauss was able to work with.
And that puts her in the position of having to decide, potentially puts her in the position of having to decide whether she's going to go off with some aristocrat who's going to bring money back into the family, mm-hmm. or follow her heart. But of course, in the beginning, she hasn't met anybody. But, you know, it's der Richtige, the right one, reminds me of so many, like the, you know, the song, Someday He'll Come Along, the Man I Love, or the one
musicals.
From Guys and... Yeah, from musical, the Guys and Dolls, I'll Know When My Love Comes Along. It's really the same exact theme.
Maybe it's the dream of many young girls, you know, before you start dating and you're looking for the right person and you know, you hope and daydream, how will he be the one I love, you know, the man I love. Or it's in many
musicals. I don't think it stops at the age of 18 either.
No, maybe not. Maybe
if you look at all the people who were trying to... Find the right person at every age. It goes on and on.
Well, this play lent itself to opera because the second act is a Viennese ball scene. And at the ball, Arabella has three very eligible suitors, none of whom she really likes. Strauss calls them in a letter to Hofmannsthal the three nincompoops because their attitude is she wants to talk in depth about subjects. And one of them says to her, oh, don't bother about that. Just live for the moment, which was sort of how people were living in Vienna in the 1860s. The end of the great Habsburg Empire was beginning to unravel and come undone. And this is the result. There's a change in a massive change in society.
Kind of a decadent period.
Yeah, it's a decadent period. So she sings this lovely aria. Near the beginning, she's with her sister. Now, this is about a family. Count Waldner, who is an inveterate gambler, who loves his family in his way, but he's much more interested in gambling. His wife, Adelaide, who's a bit of a... a bit of an airhead, and goes, she gambles too in a sense. She has a fortune teller who tells her and us the plot of the opera, what's going to happen in the very opening moments. And then the two daughters, the gorgeous Arabella, who has got to find a husband, and then Zdenka. Now, Zdenka is an interesting young woman because she's dressed as a man throughout the opera, through most of it, because the family cannot afford to launch two daughters in Viennese society, so she's dressed as a boy, and her mother rationalizes. She says, well, it's no big deal. She was always a tomboy. She's happy dressing like this. So it didn't
Which
cost
we're not
them.
Really sure if she is.
No, of course. And that unravels the plot, and there's a mistake, obviously a big tragic flaw mistake. But at this point, the two sisters are together. Arabella and Zdenka, her sister, are very close. And Arabella sings, Aber der Richtige, the one who's right for me, if there is one for me in all this world, will stand before me all at once, his eyes on mine, mine on him, and no more doubting will remain, no more asking, happy I shall be. I mean, it's very romantic and very waltz-like. So let's hear some of this, the aria. And this is sung on this recording by Hilda Gooden, who was one of the great Arabellas. And that is Arabella from Richard Strauss's Arabella. The recording we're listening to today is the Vienna Philharmonic with George Shorty conducting. Hilda Gooden is the Arabella and Waldemar Kement is Mandrika.
It's interesting to talk at this point, and we've talked about this in past years when we've been talking about opera, is typecasting versus casting for the
voice.
Best voice.
Mm.
And, of course, they try to do both, but with Arabella... I certainly hope for a kind of sweet young flower of an opera singer.
Our performer in this role is absolutely gorgeous. She's younger. Kiri Tikanawa, I think, was the singer who absolutely looked the part. I mean, she was never... Well, Arabella's probably in her mid-20s. She's not 15, as some of these women are supposed to be, youngsters. So Kiri Tikanawa absolutely looked the part. She was quite lovely. Erin Wall will be singing our Arabella. She sang Daphne here a few years ago. I think that will be lovely. So then we meet the right man, Mandrika, who is quite a character.
Mr. Wright comes along.
Mr. Wright, he does. Absolutely. The minute she finishes her aria, so to speak, has to happen quickly in opera. There's not an awful lot of time. And, of course, she recognizes him. She's actually noticed a stranger standing outside in the street, and she wonders who is that, and her feelings tell her this might be the one.
And they look into each other's eyes.
They do, but they don't do that till the second act. First of all, there's this marvelous scene with her father. The father has sent off her portrait to an old army friend in Croatia. And in those days, Croatia was a very long way from Vienna. Now, not so far. And there's a knock on the door, and Mandrika is announced. And the father's somewhat taken back. This is a young man, not the old army friend he'd expected. He was quite happy to marry his daughter off to an old army friend in Croatia. But what happens is this younger man shows up, and he explains that his uncle had died, the portrait came to him, and that he fell in love with the portrait, and he is here to ask for her hand in marriage. So there's a wonderful scene here. Can I read a little bit of what he says? He says, "That was my uncle. He is dead. I am now the last Mandrika. I hope you will forgive my being bold enough to read the note you sent. All must depend on that." And he shows the picture. And then he goes on to say what had happened to him and why he had not come the minute he got the letter. He said, He brings the letter out, the portrait and the letter, and there's sort of blood stains on it. And he tells the father, "You see, there are some blood stains on it that make it hard to read. That very day they brought me my letter. I was out hunting, chasing a she-bear. She took me on for battle and embraced me. She scratched me and cracked my ribs." They didn't use the word cracked, whatever it is. "Broke my ribs, and for 12 weeks I was lying in bed recovering, but gazing at the portrait of your daughter whom I want to marry." So he sounds marvelous, this Mandrika. Is quite a character.
Yeah, getting into love fests with bears.
Yeah, well, he's a man of the woods, and it turns out he is totally gauche when it comes to Viennese society. He has absolutely no idea of how to behave in Vienna. And the Viennese treat him as sort of a bit of an oddity, but they're quite happy to take his money and drink his wine, of course. So maybe we should hear a little of that first interview, I suppose, with the father, with Mandrika. And Mandrika is a baritone. This is an interesting opera from Strauss's point of view, because he was never really fascinated by male voices. He loved sopranos. So all of his leading ladies are these fabulous sopranos. And the men are not the strongest characters in his operas, with the exception of this one. This Mandrika is a real man. He's a baritone. And the baritone gets the girl in this opera.
I was going to say, we have talked many times about how the baritone sometimes mostly doesn't get the girl. It's always the tenor.
In this one, he does. But if he's a man from the wild woods and the forests of Croatia, maybe he needs to be a baritone.
Let's hear it.
Der Onkel ist dahin, heut bin ich der Mandrika, niemand sonst. Ein Zehn in Händen, meine Schild in Händen, für tausend Untertanen bieten, was nicht möglich sei. Wir kriegen vor meinen Augen dieses Bild.
So a lot of verbiage from Mandrika.
Oh, yes, he has a lot to say for himself. He comes in very bombastic, and quite a contrast to the sort of superficial lifestyle of Vienna. I mean, I think Strauss must have had great fun doing this. He was 69 years of age when he actually wrote this piece. I mean, he and Hofmannsthal had been working together for 30 years. And there was a sad story. Maybe we should talk about this.
Well, I was going to say Hofmannsthal died.
Yes, yes.
Before, I mean, he'd basically written it but hadn't revised the second and third act.
That's right.
The
first act had been completed after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, like we talked about, and the second and third act had been written but had not been finally polished. So Hofmannsthal sends everything off to Strauss, who says, congratulations, it looks great. And he sends the telegram back, which is how they communicated in those days. And the telegram arrived on the day that when Hugo von Hofmannsthal was dressing to go to the funeral of his son, who had committed suicide. As he's dressing, he had a massive heart attack, and he died. It was a terrible tragedy, and it really took the ground from underneath Strauss's feet. The men were very close in spite of this. They're different personalities and characters. You know, they had 30 years of incredible work together, and he really mourned him. So he decided that rather than doing all of the fine tuning and cleaning and the to-ing and fro-ing that goes on for months, years sometimes, with these operas, that the first act was just as he wanted it, but he would actually present the second and third acts as Hofmannsthal had left them, as a memorial, a tribute to him, which was a sad story in the midst of all this, which was he was having all sorts of difficulties, actually, when it came to production. The conductor that he wanted in the Dresden Opera House to conduct the premiere was Jewish, and Hitler had just been named chancellor, and the Jewish conductor was fired. So Strauss says, I don't want to do my opera here now, but they actually held him to his contract. He didn't have a choice. It had to be done. He didn't have a choice, and Clemens Krauss conducted with great success. But I'd like to play another little bit now from Mandrika, actually, in a very sweet little folksy moment. The wonderful folk moments come into German composers' music. The Germans walk so much. I think that's part of what it is. So they walk the hills and they're out thinking, walking. Beethoven apparently had his most marvelous inspirations when he was walking the Vienna woods. Wagner listened to the Song of the Birds and wrote the Forest Bird into the Ring. So it's a common German thing, perhaps. So here we have Mandrika, who is, he is now, this is the second act. He has met Arabella, and the two of them are getting to know each other, and they decide that, yes, they are right for each other. And then he tells her a wonderful little story about how people get engaged in his country, and we'll play this. He sings, this very evening at sleeping time, if you were living in a village, one I call my own, you'd go and kneel beside the well that's behind your father's house and draw a drink of water, just one goblet full, for me, who's standing by the threshold. Thus I'd be betrothed to you, and God would be our witness, lovely Arabella.
Du ein Mädchen aus den Dörfern, eine Meinigen. Du willst es mir zum Brunnen gehen, hinter deines Vaters Haus und klares Wasser schöpfen, einen Becher voll. Reichen vor der Schwelle, dass ich dein Verlobter bin, vor Gott und vor den Menschen, mein
we're listening to music from Arabella by Richard Strauss, and we're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, talking about the opera Arabella. And so where are we in the plot? So this nice gentleman caller who likes to wrestle with bears and...
Has shown up, and Arabella gets it. This is the right man.
And they look into each other's eyes, finally, and the chemistry is there. And what happens next? You think it's going to just be, well, they and lift a glass together and live happily ever after.
No, it's the second act. It has to
but
be three.
No.
No. Now the plot comes unraveled. But before that, there's a fun scene here at the fiacre ball. A fiacre is the small horse-drawn carriage that you can still actually ride around Vienna in. That's how people got about. And once a year in Vienna on Shrove Tuesday, at the end, the beginning of Lent, in those times, Carnival happened in January and February. And then at the beginning of Lent, everything had to stop. You couldn't, the opera houses were closed. Everything was closed until Easter. That was the tradition. So the tradition here with the fiacre ball is that the cabmen who drove these fiacres would bring their wives and girlfriends and daughters, the whole families, all dressed up to the nines, and they would party, typically with the aristocratic men of the time who were all dressed up and flirted and drank too much champagne. It was wild. Strauss took a little artistic license with this, in that in those real balls, no women, aristocratic women, would go. The wives and daughters had to stay home. But here, Arabella is to be feted as the queen of the ball. And the fiacre millies were the characters at the center of this, the daughters. And in this in opera, fiacre millie sings this slightly outrageous yodeling aria that everybody, you know, condemned at the time.
We're going to listen to a yodeling aria.
That was exactly the reaction of the critics at the time.
We won't subject you to it, ladies and gentlemen, for too long.
No, it's about a minute 22. It's actually quite fun, but it's a showy piece, a real coloratura of leaps and bounds of the fiacre millies. It was said of the fiacre millies, they were great sisters because they couldn't say no to any man. So here it is, fiacre millie.
Sound like yodeling?
Well, it's operatic yodeling. This is opera. You have to give it a little license. You did bring something up, though, Mary Charlotte, as we were listening to this, is how the excerpt before, the beautiful strings in this piece.
Yes. I mean, this is something to listen for. There are books. My mother has this wonderful book called A Night at the Opera, in which the author summarizes the operas and then tells you what to look for musically in each section.
Yes.
And in this one, listen to how the strings, the violins and so on, accompany the voice.
Yes, there's beautiful, lush instrumentation. In fact, I think with Strauss very often you have to try not to listen to the voice in order to listen to the music, because it's always very beautiful. And this is, in a sense, it's a Viennese waltz opera, so there's lots of strings and lots of waltzes, as we heard there. This was sort of a bit of an aberration, but I think Strauss was having fun. At 69, you can probably afford to do that. So anyway, at this point then, this is the light entertainment at the fiacre ball, and things get serious because the Zdenka comes in and she's dressed as a man, as a young man, of course, but it is a woman, which is sort of confusing in terms of gender here.
Now, don't forget, this is Arabella's sister.
Yep, dressed as a man.
Who's dressed as a man because her parents can't afford to present two women to society. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. But she's actually, it is a woman pretending to be dressed as a man. It's one of those cross-gender things.
But it's played by a woman.
played by a woman, Opera Desert all the time. So she comes on and she approaches Matteo, the officer. Now, Matteo is passionately in love with Arabella, but Arabella doesn't have any time for him. She's not interested. But nevertheless, Matteo is receiving these passionate love letters from Arabella. What has been happening is that Zdenka is all girl, and underneath the male tomboy exterior, she is in love with Matteo. So she has been writing letters to Matteo, love letters, but signing them with Arabella's name. So now she comes to him. The two boys are commiserating. Zdenka is a boy, and Matteo saying she pays no attention to me. She won't even look at me. And Zdenka says, don't worry. Here is the key to her room, and she'll meet you there in a short space of time. So he goes.
So he's playing the dude.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, she's playing the dude.
She's playing the dude, yeah. So he goes bouncing off all happy. Finally, he's going to have an assignation in a bedroom with Arabella. But who overhears this conversation but Mandrika? And Mandrika assumes the worst. She's going to have this night out or night in on the night of their betrothal. And he's absolutely furious. And it's made worse when Arabella comes in and says, well, I've said goodbye to my three counts, the three suitors, and I'm a little tired. I'm going back to the hotel early. So he's convinced that the worst is happening. So he proceeds to get very drunk, drinks too much champagne, and the parents are mortified at this point. Their new son-in-law, who owns all these forests and vast lands in Croatia, may be escaping them. So they all decide they'll go back to the hotel. The final act then opens in the hotel where Arabella has gone back early, and she's sitting in the lobby sort of reminiscing how much she loves Mandrika. And at the top of the stairs, a door opens and Matteo comes out of a bedroom. He looks over the edge of the banisters and he sees her sitting below, and he's absolutely flummoxed. He says, how can this be? I just left her in the bedroom and here she is downstairs. He didn't know he had been making love to Zdenka. Silly man. However, at this point, the rest of everybody else shows up. The Mandrika, who's furious, the parents, and half of the people at the ball who get wind of this drama. They show up in the hotel, and the whole thing is beginning to fall apart. Mandrika confronts Arabella. You've been unfaithful. What's going on? I break off the engagement. And the father says, I challenge you to a duel. And things are going downhill rapidly when the door at the top of the stairs opens again, and a young woman in a nightdress with flowing hair comes flying down the stairs, and she sings, Mama, Papa, I'm on my way to the river to drown myself for shame. I just spend the night in the arms of Matteo, who stands there with an appropriate look of shock on his face. You can imagine. So it really ratchets up to this crazy climax of total frustration. Arabella is very gentle with her sister, takes her under her arm and tries to comfort her.
Well, the thing that's nice about Arabella's character is she remains completely calm through this whole thing.
She does.
And says, Mandrika, look, what are you talking about?
Yeah, you don't trust me?
You don't trust me?
You've only known me 6 hours. We're getting married. You don't trust me? So she says, maybe he's not the right man. She actually says that at one point.
Right.
This offer can be looked at in actually quite a humorous vein. It's not to be taken too seriously.
I should hope not.
No. So the whole thing unravels then, and everything is resolved, and it's made clear what's happened. And Mandrika is now the one who is shamed because he has not trusted Arabella. And it's clear that Zdenko was with Matteo, and those two get betrothed. And then the opera comes to the final magnificent moments. This opera leads up to this final scene, which is so beautiful. Arabella says, we've had enough excitement for the night. Why doesn't everybody go home or go to bed? And she starts going up the stairs, and she turns to Mandrika and she says, can you ask your manservant to bring me a glass of water? Which he does, and she goes up to her room, and Mandrika's pacing the floor. You know, he's kicking himself. I've ruined it. I've lost her, and I'm a fool, and all the appropriate
things. I should have
trusted
her. What was I thinking?
All of those good things that you get in musicals as well, of course. And then at the last moment of the opera, the door at the top of the stairs opens again, and Arabella appears at the top with a glass of water in her hands, and she comes slowly down the staircase singing this absolutely stunningly beautiful aria. When she gets to the bottom, she hands him the glass, and he gets the symbolism. He drinks the glass, smashes it, and takes her in his arms as the opera ends. So
aww,
it's a happy ending opera.
We like those.
We like happy endings. So maybe we could play a little of the final aria, which is the great piece at the end. If we have time for that, maybe let's play some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Arabella's final aria in Arabella by Richard Strauss.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful piece, this. It's you leave the theater feeling good about life, love, and oneself, hopefully. So the music is beautiful.
And before we go, one more thing. I want to thank Peter Hull for putting together all the musical excerpts in this opera series.
Yeah, he did a great job. There's a lot of work in that.
A lot of work. And Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering and for being just an absolutely terrific sound engineer. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Desiree, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Marishanda. Another great season.
We've been speaking with Desiree Mays. She is an international speaker on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. For more information on the Santa Fe Opera, you can go to santafeopera.org. You can call 505-986-5900 or 800-280-4654. And we are talking to Jorge Gomez. He's pianist and musical director of the Cuban group Tiempo Libre, which is performing at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center this Friday night at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. How are you?
Good. It's so great to have you on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, we've been listening to music from your previous disc, which is called Bach in Havana, when we'll talk about that in a moment, but your new disc is called My Secret Radio. What is the significance of that title?
Well, that name came from the, you know, we are from Cuba, and in Cuba in the 80s, that was illegally to hear American music. So we go to the roof, and we wait until 1 a.m. to all the radio in Cuba get off this frequency, and we start to listen to American music. We invent the antennas and everything, and we try every night to catch any signal from the United States. That's why we put secret radio.
Was it really that bad? I mean, would they punish you if they found you listening to radio?
Yeah, really bad. They don't put any American music at that time. Now it's more open. At that time, well, even me, I was in jail one time, one night, because I was listening to music of the Beatles.
Oh, my
I was
goodness.
Completely illegally in Cuba.
So what was the American music that you liked and that influenced you as a musician?
A lot. I used to, at the beginning, I loved to hear jazz, like Chick Corea, Chaka Khan, Kenny Killan, Keith Jarrett, Jaco Pastorius. But with time, I start listening to Edwin and Fire, Cool and Again, Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, everything. It was so amazing. That was a new door for us.
Now, you were a musician, and you went through your training, as I think many musicians do in Cuba, even if they're playing salsa and timba and popular music, real rigorous conservatory training. What was that like?
That was illegally, too. In the school that we study, you only can play classical music, not even Cuban music. If they catch you playing Cuban music, you are out of the school, out, no more. So you have to learn how to play Cuban music in a secret way, on your neighborhood or with some musician. That was a little complicated.
And so, in other words, people who had been playing conga drums for generations and bata weren't allowed to play those in conservatories, or how did that work?
They learned that from the street, from the street. They learned the conga, the guaguancó, all those rhythms is in the street, in the neighborhood, not in the school. In the school, they teach you the technique, and now they teach you the real style, you know? But at that time, no, that was completely out of the ordinary, no, illegal.
So you were studying Beethoven and Mozart and Bach and all of that?
Uh-huh. That's why we did the album called Bach in Havana.
Right.
Because that was our life in Cuba. In the morning, you know, mathematics, chemistry, the normal thing that you do in the school. In the afternoon, music, singing, dancing, harmony, solfeo, everything. And in the night, in your neighborhood, you were listening the conga, the cha-cha-cha, and song, everything. And we mixed everything, we put everything together, and we did that album.
So who were your teachers and inspirations for Cuban music, guaguancó and everything else, song?
Oh, first of all, you're Cuban. You have the rhythm in your veins, in your soul. Nobody has to teach you how to play a guaguancó because you know already how to play a guaguancó. And the other thing is, put everything together and enjoy. Right now, in the band, you know, every musician plays his own instrument, the bass, the piano, the trumpet, the sax, but everybody in the band, they know how to play a guaguancó in the conga, for sure.
Very interesting. We're talking to Jorge Gomez of Tiempo Libre. So tell our audience, what is timba? That is a form of music that you play.
That's the evolution of the Cuban salsa, of the Cuban song. But basically, it's the mix between jazz and Cuban rhythms. For example, if you put Buena Vista Social Club and Chick Corea playing together, that's timba.
And there's also an influence of American rap.
Ah, of course. It's evolution. You put in the timba everything. You put bossa nova, samba, hip-hop, reggaeton, whatever. The point is that you hear that, and you always going to hear a Cuban rhythm.
So some of your songs are what we might call timba, and some of them really have that jazz sound where there's the improvisational jazz. And how does the more improvisational jazz work when you are performing for dancers?
It came natural. It came with the music. For example, we are playing a song, and you say, okay, this song is going to sound better if I put a trumpet solo. So I see the musician and I say, do a solo. And he do a solo, and it sounds great.
When did you go to Miami? How old were you?
I'm 40. I left Cuba when I was 25. I went to Guatemala. I lived there for 5 years. And I came to the United States in 2000. And I started playing with Albita Rodriguez, a wonderful Cuban singer.
Yeah.
And you know, you know Celia Cruz, Cachao, everybody. You play sometime with them, and we did the band here.
Ah, okay. So how did it affect your musical life when you left Cuba? What did you do in Guatemala, and then how did it affect you as a musician being in Miami and not being in Cuba anymore?
Well, in my case, I was learning all the time. Because even in Guatemala, for example, I learned how to play marimba, how to play the sones, a merengue, and first of all, how to understand the computer thing, because in Cuba, I don't have a computer. But in Guatemala, I have the possibility to understand that and to study computer, the studio, the recordings thing, producer. So that was fantastic for me. And that was incredible, because when you came to the United States, you came prepared.
Right. I always wonder, I mean, the thing that is so amazing to me about Cuba is that all these Cuban rhythms and Cuban musicians are able to incorporate music from every other part of the world, from classical, as we've heard, funk and jazz, and just about everything else, and they're still completely grounded in that Cuban sound. How do you understand, how do you explain that incredible strength and power and self-confidence of music from this small nation of Cuba?
Wow. Well, first of all, most of the time, all the Cuban musicians, they study in the school. For example, in Tiempo Libre Band, we study all together in the same school for 15 years. So you know the instrument, you know the Cuban rhythm, so it's very easy to add different international music like bossa nova, like reggae, like calypso, soca, because you know what are you doing.
What was the school that you and your colleagues studied at?
National School of Art. It's like a Julia Art in Europe.
Right. So you will be at the Lenzik on Friday night playing all this kinds of music, and we're really looking forward to having you. And it's part of, I don't think this has really been publicized that much, but it's part of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Have you ever played in a chamber music setting before?
Of course. All the time. But it's not going to be a normal concert. It's going to be a Cuban party. So you have to be prepared to dance with the chamber orchestra, with the chamber music, with the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, but in cha-cha-cha style, in danzón style. You're going to hear Lágrimas Negras, Son de la Loma, El Manicero.
I'm so looking forward to it. I have to ask you, what do you miss about Cuba, and what do you not miss about Cuba?
Well, I miss from Cuba everything. The smell. When you go to Cuba, you smell the country, the grass, the people, your neighborhood, the food, the way that they are, you know, very open, very, oh my God, hola, amigos, it's like a party every day. But here in the United States, we have freedom. We can do whatever we want, and we don't need to explain nobody what you are doing.
Very interesting. What are your hopes for the relationship between the two countries?
I have to be open, because politics is not a bad thing, but it's not good also. And for the musician, music is like an ambassador. You don't need a language to understand music. So it's very important for us that they open that wall and be free to exchange music from the United States and from Cuba.
Jorge Gomez is the musical director and pianist of Tiempo Libre, and Tiempo Libre is performing this Friday night at 8 o'clock at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafemc. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we're on Twitter at radiocafemc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.
Ya no me quiero marchar, amiguete de... ¡Vaya!